This podcast is supported by Starglow Media's Mysteries About True Histories. From the creators of the hit, top-ranking kids educational podcast in the world, Who Smarted, the Emmy-nominated Nat Geo Disney Plus's Brain Games, and Netflix's Brain Child, comes Mysteries About True Histories, affectionately known as MATH, or math, in which kids ages 6 and up can hear humorous and educational stories that follow two best friends, Max and Molly, while they go on adventures through time, solving puzzles, hidden equations, talking about history, and making learning cool. Episodes transport listeners to moments in history like Pythagoras's ancient Greece, the era of the Aztecs, Sir Isaac Newton's England, and more. When I drive my son to school in the morning, we listen to these episodes that fit perfectly in our commute, with the episodes being about 15 minutes long. And this podcast is right up my son's alley because he loves to solve problems and happens to love math and the types of punny jokes that Max likes to tell. So tune in to Mysteries About True Histories with your kids. You can follow and listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pods. Welcome to Mom and Mind. I'm perinatal psychologist and host Dr. Kat. There is more to the story than just postpartum depression. This podcast aims to share it all, from personal stories and lived experience to experts who break down the ups and downs of life from getting pregnant, pregnancy, perinatal loss, and postpartum adjustment to new parenthood. While this is not psychotherapy or medical advice, it is all of the stuff you ever wanted to know about mental health and new parenthood.
Welcome back, everyone, to Mom and Mind. I'm your host, Dr. Kat. And I'm thrilled that you were here with us today. I've been looking forward to having this interview with Eleanor Cleghorn for some time now. After reading her book, Unwell Women, Misdiagnosis and Myth in a Man-Made World, let me just start by saying that as I was reading through this book, I just felt both inspired and enraged by the history of how modern medicine anyways, and Western medicine has treated women and women's medical conditions and mental health conditions. What I think you will pick up in this interview is just how much history there is and how through time we have all learned and how through time it's all just been absorbed into us. We have learned how to think poorly of ourselves and in some ways learn to expect not getting the treatment that we need from our care providers, or even being believed by the people around us. And this is not a modern issue. It's been happening for a long, long time. And throughout this book, we get so much information as to the how and the why and the what. I'm really thrilled for you guys to hear this interview, but even more than that, to go and get this book. I listened to this book as an audiobook and purchased the hard copy as well so that I could really highlight a lot of the areas in the book that I wanted to be able to come back to. I view this book as a really important reference for us to understand some of the history that connects us to why we feel the way we feel now, why we feel unheard and dismissed. It's been in our medical systems for a long, long time. Eleanor really digs into a lot of this history, but there is so much more in the book. So in this interview today, you will hear some of this history as Eleanor discusses it with us. I do believe that this interview will start to give you some of the insight into this history. Eleanor Cleghorn is a feminist cultural historian, and her critical writing has been published in several academic journals. After receiving her PhD in 2012, Eleanor spent 3 years as a postdoctoral researcher at the Ruskin School, University of Oxford, working on an interdisciplinary medical humanities project. She is the author of Unwell Women, Misdiagnosis and Myth in a Man-Made World, and I can't wait for you guys to get to this interview, so let's not wait another second. Let's meet Eleanor. Welcome, Eleanor. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am sort of having my own fangirl moment to be able to talk with you today. I have listened to and read through your book, Unwell Women. And as soon as I started listening to it, I knew that how pertinent it would be to the perinatal period and just women's experience in general, and very specifically the arc of what you go through from the beginning of recorded history, essentially on women's health, all the way to present. And I believe one of their reviews on your book is, yes, I read it in rage and recognized myself in its pages. And that is exactly how I felt as well. You've done an incredible amount of work on this book, and it is just, in my view, so, so important in for all women to read. So I just thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for reading, for such kind words.
I think it's a really important book, and I want to get into all of those details. But first, I know that a lot of this book was, I guess you could say, inspired by your own personal experience and the work that you do. So I'd love for you to start from there and kind of let us know what brought you to writing this book.
Of course. So Unwell Women began as a germ of an idea in 2010, just after I was diagnosed with the chronic autoimmune disease called lupus. And I was diagnosed after having a really complicated pregnancy with my second son, in which he presented with a condition called congenital heart block when I was about 25 weeks pregnant. Mm. And congenital heart block is quite a rare condition, and it happens when the node, the AV node that controls the way that the fetal heart beats, is damaged, and then the fetal heart rate slows down. So all the while he was in me, he was safe because he was being regulated by my heart and my blood. So the important thing was really to get his heart healthy so that when he was born, he wouldn't need to have a pacemaker or surgery. So this was a real shock, and I had no idea what might be causing this. My consultants, amazing fetal cardiologists who work at St. Thomas's Hospital in London, explained to me that it might be being caused by something that was happening in my own immune system. They told me that I might be producing a cell that was crossing the placental barrier and attacking my baby's heart. So this was quite a lot to take on, that it was something that my body was doing to my baby, that my body wasn't providing this protective space, that it was actually mounting an attack on my baby. So psychically, this was very difficult to understand and upsetting. But I had blood tests that showed that I did carry this immune abnormality that is associated with women who have lupus. So I didn't at that stage have a diagnosis. Everything was focused on the care of my unborn baby, on making sure that his heart function would be regulated. He was born healthy and well, thanks to steroids that I took, to constant monitoring, to incredible fetal cardiologists. And thankfully, all was well, and the block was negligible when he was born. But when he was about 9 weeks old, I got very sick and I developed a heart condition of my own. Gosh. I was hospitalized. The heart condition was very mysterious. And my consultants were baffled as to what was now causing my own heart to fail. It wasn't until a rheumatologist came to see me from another hospital and looked at my notes that anyone considered my pregnancy history in relation to my current state of health. So nobody had thought to put the puzzle pieces together and think that the process that had damaged my baby's heart was perhaps now damaging mine. And this rheumatologist did put those puzzle pieces together, and he did make a diagnosis of lupus. So there was an explanation now for what happened to my baby and what was happening to me. So I was immediately put into the care of excellent lupus consultants and experts in the field, given the correct medication, and I was able to begin this kind of slow road to some sort of recovery. But as I was doing this very slow business of recovering, I became really fixated on why all these things had happened, why I'd fallen between these, you know, gaps of knowledge, why I wasn't diagnosed more quickly, why my condition hadn't been uncovered earlier so that I didn't have to go through these two life-threatening events. So I started to mine medicine's history for some answers to some of the questions that my doctors just couldn't explain. And I was a historian at the time working on art history. So I started sort of Googling my way around medicine's history to try and figure out some things about lupus that still were so elusive to me. And I kept discovering these case studies of unwell women with lupus in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, in the 1950s. And they all had these really important things in common. They all described women who had mysterious symptoms, pain, complications in pregnancy, heart difficulties, but were left undiagnosed, sometimes for years, sometimes for 10 years. Before being diagnosed with a disease called lupus. And I thought, okay, medicine has progressed exponentially as a science across a century. But yet, why is it that the diagnostic process that women have to go through and hasn't progressed at all? Like, why do we know how to medicate a disease, but not how to treat the sufferers of that disease? So that's where Unwell Women began, from this urgency that I felt to not only uncover this kind of kernel, this kind of knotty truth about my own disease and the possible gender biases surrounding it, but also to trace where that bias had come from. And over time, the more interested I became in these medical case studies, the more my attention expanded to other diseases that are often discussed in relation to things like lupus. So conditions like endometriosis, conditions like multiple sclerosis, uterine fibroids, polycystic ovarian syndrome. These diseases and conditions that so often go misdiagnosed or where diagnosis is delayed for many years and where there seems to be very little research and understanding. And crucially, the diseases that women seem to have to convince their doctors of the validity. So women have to convince their doctors of the pain. And these diseases all had something in common. So Unwell Women, that's where it began, from this anger and also fascination with why this was still happening in the 21st century.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like you uncovered quite a bit. And I mean, from the book, I can see how far back you went in time to see not necessarily where it started, but where we have it recorded that it started and different ways that women have been viewed medically and emotionally throughout history. What was so disheartening to me when, and true when reading this, is there's just so many kernels of truth from that still linger. Rather, I shouldn't say kernels of truth, but kernels of misinformation and misunderstanding about women and women's health and mental health that have persisted years, year after year, since recorded history, it looks like. So I can't even imagine how long it took you to figure all of this out and find all of this information, because this is so dense with all of these examples, which all of it, I'm sure you didn't even put everything you found in this book. There must be so much there. So first of all, thank you for taking your pain and the misunderstanding from doctors and turning it into this resource for the rest of us, because I think it is a resource. If you can then maybe start back in time to, I think the book starts in ancient Greece, essentially from the beginning of our kind of current medical roots, I should say. Anyhow, if you can start there and tell us what you found back in ancient Greece.
Of course. So it's really important to me to begin at the beginning. And Of course, you're completely right. Women's bodies, minds, emotions, physical symptoms far exceed the beginnings of what we call modern medical thinking. But it was important for me to begin in ancient Greece, where we have the formation of medical practice and thought that has been the model that we've more or less followed for the last more than 2,000 years. And it was really the point in history in which women's bodies and minds became medicalized for the first time in the sense that we understand that today. It was the first time where women's bodies were being scrutinized and women's minds also being scrutinized by male through this kind of male medical lens. And of course, ancient Greece was a deeply, deeply patriarchal society. So the understanding of women's bodies and minds that emerged at the beginnings of medical history was tainted by this extremely sexist, narrow vision of what women were for, why women existed, what the purpose of women was. And this idea that women existed primarily as reproductive vessels, as carriages for future generations of children, principally of male heirs, really did cloud how women's bodies and minds were viewed in this medical thinking. So the first medical authors that I talk about in Unwell Women are the Hippocratic authors. Now, we know Hippocrates, we know the name Hippocrates, because our health professionals all swear a version of the Hippocratic Oath, which is, of course, first do no harm, which is kind of an ironic statement considering when we think about how that oath has not necessarily been applied to us all. Right. Anyway, so the Hippocratic authors were a collection of medical writers working around the 4th and 5th century in the BCE, in the tradition of physician named Hippocrates. And they wrote treatises and tracts about all aspects of human health and illness, including several volumes about women's health and about human generation, and a little tiny bit about child, the care of the newborn, but not so much. So they were the first authors to really map and define women's illnesses of the body and of the mind. Now, a deeply patriarchal society like ancient Greece that sees women as foremost reproductive vessels considered women's bodies very much through the prism of their reproductive function and their reproductive organs. So the uterus was the principal organ of medical thinking right at its very beginnings in terms of women's health. And the ancient Greeks believed that because women were destined and put on the earth effectively to procreate and to bear and raise children, that all of their health issues circulated around their uteruses and around where they were in relationship to conceiving, carrying, or mothering children. So the uterus became this really sort of contested site of problems and difficulties. And in many ways, the ancient Greeks saw the uterus as an organ that was controlling women's bodies. Because if women wanted, above all else, to procreate, then it was almost as if their bodies were being sort of driven to by this organ that wanted to perform that function above any other function. So the ancient Greeks put an awful lot of responsibility and duty into the uterus, and they even endowed it with a certain capacity to move and act on its own behalf. The ancient Greeks actually believed that the womb could wander. The uterus, if it wasn't performing its duty of conceiving or being weighed down with a child, that the uterus would become mischievous and start to creep towards other organs in the body, start to creep towards the liver or the heart or the diaphragm. And as it crept, start causing all manner of symptoms, from pain to convulsions, to fevers, to chills, to stomach issues. So from the very beginning, women's health was intimately tied into their reproductive capacity and to the behavior, if you will, of the principal reproductive organ, the uterus.
No pressure, uterus.
Right. That's,
I mean, there's so.
This podcast is supported by Understood Explains. As parents, we are often having to figure out things as we go, and that is very true for our children's education. And to help you out, I want to tell you about a podcast called Understood Explains. This season is hosted by teacher and special education expert Uliana Ortube, and she discusses all the things you'd want to know about individual education plans, or IEPs, what they are, why they're needed, who benefits from them, and what to expect when you have meetings with teachers. I could have really used this podcast when my son had an IEP for speech when he was 6. I was overwhelmed trying to understand the process and what everything meant. The episode on Understood Explains, Does My Child Need an IEP, was the kind of info that would have really helped me get the most out of the educational support of the IEP for my son. And if you need that kind of support, I really recommend this podcast. To listen to Understood Explains, search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains.
Hello, you sentient ball of stardust. My name is Casey Davis. I'm a therapist and I'm an author of the book, How to Keep House While Drowning, where I talk about ways to make it a little bit easier to take care of yourself when you're overwhelmed, stressed, have mental health issues, physical health issues, or maybe you're just in a hard season of life. Maybe you're looking for a place that you can come and listen to some practical advice. This is a podcast for all of the self-help rejects. We're going to talk about skills for survival and self-kindness. And I'm going to leave the pop psychology at the door. I promise not to tell you to meditate or to journal. We're just going to give you some really insightful conversations with hopefully some practical advice. So I don't believe you need to pick yourself up by the bootstraps. I don't want you to just try harder, and I don't believe that laziness exists. So join me over on Struggle Care, where we can find compassionate solutions that help us function a little bit better.
From what I understand from your book, there weren't at the time, there weren't people really doing a lot of looking into the body to see where the actual structures were. There wasn't the sort of autopsies and medical examinations that we have had since then. So this was just an idea,
yeah,
a thought.
It was a thought and idea, because human dissection was not prohibited in the ancient Greek world. So although physicians later did perform dissections on animals and then began to learn that perhaps a uterus could not wander, that it may be tethered by sinews and ligaments into the body, the ancient Greeks weren't able to look inside the body. So they were figuring out what was happening inside the body by observing only the external symptoms, the things they could see and hear and touch. So a lot of the way that they characterized the uterus in a medical sense was actually in a sort of social way. So it's like putting two and two together and making five. Women are reproductive. Women need to reproduce. That's why they exist. So therefore, if they're sick, it must be something to do with that. Something to do with where they stand in relation to their reproductive life cycle. And they would observe symptoms. For example, there was a disease that the Hippocratic physicians described called the suffocation of the uterus, which was where they believed that the uterus was sort of impacting the diaphragm and women would feel as if they were choking. Now, we could kind of go back and diagnose all sorts of possibilities for a sense of fullness and choking in the throat. But for them, when they didn't have this understanding of how the body worked in a more intricate sense, they made this assumption, well, the womb is rising up. And the main medicine for a mischievous womb is marital sex and pregnancy. So it was both a very convenient way for these medical men to assert a certain amount of social control over women, because that is the only way they had to understand how women's bodies would work. And it was also a limitation of knowledge as well. So the two things collide, the lack of knowledge or the ignorance and the desire to control women kind of come together to create this bevy of strange uterine fictions that I really think have haunted women's health ever since.
Oh, right. So both the misunderstanding of what's happening in the body and the quote unquote cure, or you talk a lot about this dance throughout history of how understanding has changed from sort of one medical generation to the next. And certainly if it's more in the hands of the like patriarchal societies, which mostly, and throughout the book, you're speaking mostly from kind of a European and North American perspectives, is the history that you're drawing upon. So for sure, I mean, we can say that these are patriarchal societies. What they have done over time, certainly things have changed over time, but as you said, that this thread still runs through, that making assumptions about what's going on in the body and then making an assumption about how to best support or help. And even I can maybe say that over time, I think the intentions have been better and more woman-centered, but still pretty misguided. Is that fair? Yeah.
I think that's completely fair. I think, of course, with each generation of medical thought in the Western medical model that I talk about the history of in this book, with each generation of medical thought comes an expanded understanding of the human body and its illnesses. But something that I think remains fairly consistent when it comes to women's health and the understanding of women's bodies across that history is that because medicine has been so male dominated across its history, these mythologies and fictions about what women's bodies are for and how women's bodies work and also how women's minds behave in relation to their bodies, I think these myths and fictions have really stuck because they're not just about medical thought about the body, they're also about societal ideas about women and women's roles and women's place. And so those things have become very baked in to medical thinking, even as it's progressed as a science, even as it's progressed into the biomedical model that we understand it to be today, the evidence-based model. There is still, it's almost as if we're haunted still by fictions like the wandering womb or, you know, diagnostic fantasies like hysteria. We're still, although these terms aren't in play, we hope, in our doctor's offices, the shape or form or shadow of those ideas do linger, because for so long medicine has been a patriarchal practice that has always reflected something larger about the social order. And we're talking about centuries of medical thinking being laid down before women were even permitted to have licenses to practice medicine, which didn't happen until the late 19th century. Now, of course, women have always practiced medicine and always cared for their bodies and other bodies. But in terms of the thinking and discourse that has become laid down as medicine with a big capital M, women have really been exempted from that formal history until the end of the 19th century. So there was an awful lot to unpack and unpick by the time women were formally allowed to become physicians. So it feels a lot like so much unchecked power or unchecked patriarchal dominance baked into medicine. And we haven't had that long to undo it, really. I mean, just over a century to unravel that and redress it and correct this, these long-held beliefs, or misbeliefs, I should say, about women's bodies and minds.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched on a couple of things that I want to come back to there. This idea of hysteria and women being hysteric. I unfortunately do hear that word still. I mean, as it relates to not just sort of putting a woman down, but it's the underpinnings of it, the feeling and meaning of it are still held, I believe, in many ways, but maybe a little more subtle now. But there are ways in which women now hear, oh, she's just acting crazy. She's just whatever. It's some other form or word that is horrible and absolutely dismissive. You talk about the word hysteric, and there's a bit in here that I just want to read in the early chapters. You say here, by the later decades of the 1800s, hysteria was synonymous with deranged feminine behaviors and emotions. It's no surprise that emerging mind and nerve doctors, alienists, and neurologists were eager to pin down that amorphous object and define it on their own terms. So that is important. I mean, this to me doesn't feel like that long ago. Certainly that we were able to take some control of this misunderstanding of us as beings. But if you can speak to some of that history and how it is of hysteria, the word, where it came from and how it's showing up now.
Of course. So hysteria as a diagnostic term emerged in around the 17th century in English medical writings. But the word hysteria actually derives from the ancient Greek word for uterus or womb, which is hystera. And when the physicians who were interested in the influence of women's uteruses on their minds and vice versa began thinking about this in the 17th century, it was no coincidence that they started to use this word hysteria that had these roots in an ancient Greek word that was used for an organ that was always seen as being very volatile, right? And having that sort of wandering capacity. So hysteria didn't begin with ancient Greece necessarily as a medical diagnosis, but that's where the seeds were sown. This idea that a woman's uterus has a very profound influence on her body and mind, and that disorders and distempers of the uterus could inflict such a vast array of mental and physical symptoms. So hysteria emerges around the 17th century as a way of explaining some of the more inexplicable symptoms that women patients were suffering, that their doctors were observing. And one of the first treatises on hysteria actually emerged as a counter-argument to the physical and emotional manifestations of apparent witchcraft and demonic possession. So across the 15th, between the 15th and 17th centuries across Europe, about 45,000 people were penalized and accused and executed for apparent crimes of witchcraft. About 80% of those are estimated to have been women. As the witchcraft craze, as it has become known, began to wane in Europe, certain more humane-minded doctors started to think about what really was happening. Mm-hmm. Evidently, women were not actually casting spells or communing with the devil. So what was it, these physicians wondered, that was making them behave as if they were? And one particular physician called Edward Jordan decided that it was because the uterus was unwell, and it was inflicting such bizarre symptoms in women that they would appear as if under the dominion of spells. And so when he categorized hysteria, he really introduced this idea that hysteria was any symptom you couldn't explain that was happening in a woman could be linked back to her uterus and some disorder of it. Because he saw the principal sufferers of hysteria as being younger women and older women. So women around the age of first menstruation, women around the age of menopause in our modern understanding. So he categorized that something was happening in the uterus that was effectively driving women crazy, driving both their bodies and minds awry. So from this idea, hysteria started its life as a very convenient diagnosis for an array of mental and physical symptoms that doctors didn't necessarily understand and couldn't necessarily put a cause to. And I often say when I'm asked about hysteria that hysteria is a made-up idea that was imposed upon women, and it served, again, as a way of controlling women. It served as a mechanism of social control, but it also served to assuage doctors' ignorance about what was really happening in a woman's body and mind. There's not really one consistent definition of hysteria. Some physicians listed anything and everything you could imagine, from emotionality to nervous disorders to issues with menstruation to pain. Others had a more narrow definition, but it was what it always had in common was this tendency to associate very closely what was going on in a woman's mind, so her personality, her behavior, her emotions, with what was going on in her reproductive system. It was a way of creating this link, this sort of accusatory link between these two organs in a woman's body. So it really caught on. It became a very popular diagnosis for many women's illnesses. And it really gained prevalence in the 19th century with this image of the hysterical woman who either her symptoms and her pain were being created by her mind, or either her mind was creating her symptoms and pain. So there was always a way to sort of bring back this idea of hysteria to the woman. She was right. creating herself. She wasn't behaving, so her body was acting up, or she wasn't treating her body properly and doing what she should with it, so her mind was overreacting. So it was a very accusatory, very victim-blaming form of diagnosis. But it was also dangerously broad, so it masked an awful lot of genuine illness and suffering beneath it.
Right, for sure. Nothing else is being addressed, and nothing else is being treated, because it doesn't even exist, essentially, in their mind. What I find really infuriating about all of this throughout the book, things that you're describing, is that from what I can tell, at no time was there an understanding that the societal pressures that women were facing were potentially part of why they were feeling the way that they were. And that is any form of like oppression, not having any rights, feeling like they have no say in their life. And I think in the most extreme versions of this are what you're describe about what happened reproductively, and more than that, when it comes to slavery and medical experimentation, just like a total disregard for the humanity of the women, and really not any understanding that what someone is going through has any bearing on how they might be feeling.
Totally. We see time and again this pathology of hysteria being applied to women whose social circumstances or personal circumstances were difficult, tragic, extremely hard, or they'd been through something extremely challenging and difficult. I always remember this one case study of a young woman who was taken to a hospital, a psychiatric facility, a lunatic asylum, as it was known then, in the sort of mid-19th century, and diagnosed with hysteric affection. And her case study described how her father had died, how she'd lost her brother in an illness, how she was working all day in a mill and having to come home and look after the young ones, and her mother was sick. And it described this excruciatingly difficult life for a young woman. I think she was about 17. And rather than addressing those circumstances of her life humanely and treating her as a person, all the case study fixated on was her tendency to have uncontrollable fits of laughing and crying, and her sort of the way that she was apparently overly flirtatious with the nurses, or this kind of that's all that it focused on. The details of her life were a sidebar almost. And nobody ever reflected in that case study on just the hardship, on how difficult her life was, and how she had no outlet, she had no space to be herself, no way to express what it meant to her to be a young woman at that time in history. And this happens again and again, a complete denial, as you say, of the humanity of women, and the just simply how difficult it was to be a woman throughout so much of history, especially in relationship to choice around what you do with your body.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if we sort of titrate it down to what's happening right now, it still happens. This is one of those threads of how history remains in this way, that you should essentially be able to do everything and be everything and not complain about it. There should be no reason for you to be upset for anything. I'm talking about, this is just day-to-day living, let alone mental health concerns or physical health, like real illnesses. Somehow we should, as women, just suck it up and go on about our day and our life and not complain. It still happens all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So touching back again a little bit, you do touch on some of the really, I mean, I have so many words for it, but for now I'll just say inhumane and backwards ways that how medical, I don't even know the word that I want to use, medical leverage, I guess, was used against women in slavery and Black women in particular to further cut them off from having any even sense of feeling in their body, that somehow because of their race, that they didn't feel anything. And so medical experimentations were happening and without any form of, I guess, pain management, for lack of a better word. Can you speak a little bit to that history and how medical understanding was used to the benefit of the so-called physicians?
Of course. So in the early mid 19th century in Alabama, a physician named James Marion Sims practiced, and he was a physician who treated people who worked on plantations in a town called Montgomery. And he was a unique physician in that his principal clients were plantation owners, were slave owners. And he treated enslaved people when they were injured or unwell. He was one day sent to look at a young woman named Anaka who had given birth and had suffered an injury called a vesicovaginal fistula, which at the time was deemed incurable. And the slave owner, Anaka was unable to work. So the slave owner, and it's so awful to say, but had no use for her, and effectively handed her over as a medical specimen to Sims, who was a gynecologist who had improvised a gynecological hospital in his backyard of his home. Now, Sims always professed to have absolutely no interest in reproductive medicine or gynecological medicine, and even admitted to being disgusted by this aspect of female anatomy. So you can imagine the complete lack of respect he gave to an enslaved woman. But Sims decided that he would try to cure the vesicovaginal fistula. And he did this by experimenting on Anaka, whom he purchased from her owner. And then he began to experiment on multiple other young enslaved women to develop gynecological procedures, many of which are in practice today. Now, Sims gained a reputation as being the father of American gynecology, but the foundations of his reputation were the abuse, exploitation, dehumanization of enslaved women who were just treated like objects, who were subjected to multiple experimental surgeries, always without anesthetic. And his autobiography, which was actually published after his death, is one of the most difficult things I've ever read. Not only for its description of the utterly harrowing procedures that were performed on these women, but for the vainglorious, almost frivolous way that he revels in his own glory as a savior of women, while completely denying what he put these women through, by treating them as nothing more than objects. And it really is an evil work to read. And what is also so completely harrowing is that I think it's only recently that the names of these women have been restored to history, thanks to some incredible research by scholars in really returning the truth of Sims' experiments to our history. And there was a monument of Sims, a statue of Sims, that stood at the Harlem end of Central Park for many years and was eventually torn down or removed in 2018 after years of community protests. And the names of some of the women that Sims experimented on were then sort of replaced and held up by protesters to really draw attention to this harrowing part of gynecological medicinal history. So we come to this awful episode in medicine's history through various factors, one being that it was not believed at the time that Sims was performing these experiments that enslaved people felt pain in the same way that non-enslaved people did. There were attitudes transplanted from racist anthropology that one of the reasons that people could be enslaved was because they were less than human and more akin to animals. And so therefore there was a sort of justification that Sims held in terms of the attitude that the women he was experimenting with, he didn't think about their pain because he didn't believe they could feel any. And it's an incredibly, incredibly disturbing moment to talk about, but I think it's exceptionally important to talk about the roots of gynecological violence and reproductive abuse that happen to so many women today still,
yes,
across our world.
Yes.
And when we begin to unravel, when we look at episodes like of our history, like James Marion Sims, we understand that the kinds of thinking, the kinds of attitudes that have allowed this to happen. And then we can hopefully move towards a space where this doesn't happen. But sadly, it's a very real factor of women's experience in many parts of the world.
Yeah, most definitely.
Well, hey there, busy mama. Are you looking for ways to make your life easier, your home less chaotic, and at the same time, add more joy to your life? My name is Deanna Yates, and I'm the host of Wanna Be Clutter Free, a podcast all about letting go of the stuff we don't need in our lives so that we can focus on what truly matters. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you to throw it all away or make you feel guilty about keeping something you love, no matter how many other people don't quite understand it. But I will give you practical and, more importantly, actionable advice so that you can make progress right away. And you won't just hear it from me. There are amazing guests too. It's like having your bestie in your pocket, telling you it's okay to let go of the things that are not serving you and your family in a totally non-judgmental way. So join me over on the podcast where we can work on progress over perfection for those of us that want to be clutter-free.
I'm Margaret.
And I'm Amy.
And together we host the podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood.
Margaret, I would say you're sort of a where are my keys kind of mom.
Correct. Sometimes a where are my kids kind of mom. Well, you're, Amy, more of a we were supposed to leave 35 seconds ago, mom.
I mean, touche. In each episode of What Fresh Hell, we come at a topic from our usually completely opposite perspectives. I bring the research.
And I bring kind of the gimlet eye. Like, is that research really going to work, people?
And almost 10 million downloads later, we're still laughing.
We also talk to experts in the parenting field, plus parents with stories we can all learn from.
We make each other laugh, we challenge each other's assumptions, and we have what we think is the best parenting community on the internet.
Check out What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, wherever you listen to podcasts.
And this is precisely one of the reasons why I think this book, Unwell Women, that you wrote is so vitally important, is because the feelings that we are left with as women is that our pain doesn't matter. Our truth and reality, what we experience, doesn't matter. And in the perinatal mental health world and reproductive justice specifically, we're talking about Black women and women of color, these kind of beliefs permeate still from in medical communities and specifically in the birth rooms, hospitals in particular. Unfortunately, I mean, there are a lot of assumptions that still that Black women don't feel pain in the same way, or that if they are describing pain, they're just sort of what have I heard? They're being dramatic, or they're just attention seeking, or any number of incredibly dismissive terms. We are still dealing with this. And in terms of mental health in particular, I think it gets, how can I say, because there's not, let's say, like a body organ necessarily to point to. It's, we're talking about an experience that you can't necessarily put a finger on. Physicians, mental health practitioners, even still, how do I want to say, when it comes to maternal mental health, perinatal mental health, things like pregnancy anxiety, postpartum depression, postpartum psychosis, even, it's still so misunderstood. And in part, it's because of all of what you've talked about in this book. is that no attention or not enough attention has been given, number one. And number two, what attention has been given has been very incomplete, misguided. So here we are still left. And I'm pretty well versed in the world that I work in my career. But still, as I was reading your book, I was like, oh my gosh, that's why. Oh my gosh, that's why. And I kept making all of these connections to why I and many other women that I support feel the way that they do. There's deep, deep roots here in the history. And it's your work in uncovering and putting together the history rather in this way, I think is so empowering. It gives us a chance to say like, oh, right, that is why I feel the way that I feel. And I believe gives us more power to do something differently.
Thank you for saying that, because that was so much of my motivation to write the book in the first place, was to understand that what had happened to me in terms of my missed and delayed diagnosis with lupus and then the complications of my pregnancy were not my fault, but and actually the fault of this embedded, long, thorny, vexed history that has gone so unchallenged for so much of our history. And I wanted to expand that out, because it's not just about me. I am one of hundreds, thousands, millions of women across the world for whom this is a reality, whether that happens during pregnancy, postpartum, whether that happens in everyday health, from gynae checkups to menstrual health to menopause care, whether that happens because you have a chronic illness or even an injury, something emergent. We've all have this story, and I feel like to understand how deep-rooted that history is, then we can address it, then we can understand that it isn't our fault, it's not our fault. We're trying to be careful within a system that's too often rigged against us because we are women.
Yes, absolutely. And to that point, I just want to go back a little bit and touch on, you talk a little bit about the writing, the yellow wallpaper, about a woman who is experiencing severe mental symptoms and who was disregarded by medicine, but also by her own husband. Correct? Yes, I'm correct. Yeah. I thought I was misremembering for a second. Can you speak a little bit to what you've seen just about the mental health throughout history? And for women in particular, yes.
Absolutely. I mean, the mental and physical health in women has always been deeply intertwined across medicine's history and has often been interpreted as this channel existing, if you will, between uterus and brain, uterus and mind. And so often when descriptors of things like hysteria are made, there are a lot of judgments are brought in about women's emotions, women's robustness, women's ability to adapt to their social circumstances comes up an awful lot. Of course, as you said earlier, for so much of our history, women's circumstances have been very limited. Women's circumstances have been very controlled and curtailed, especially in terms of what they can do with their bodies, how they can behave and feel sexually, how they can express themselves creatively. These things have all been very curtailed. And especially across the 19th century, women's symptoms of women's mental health were often viewed as their own failing. So if a woman was feeling, to use an old medical word, melancholy or nervous, rather than thinking, okay, this is because she is perhaps suffering through postnatal depression or perhaps through another form of mental ill health, these mental ill health symptoms would be attributed to her failure to just adapt and accept her role as a mother, a wife, a childbearer. And I think that this resonates now very much. I think that we misunderstand, or so much of our culture misunderstands, mental health in women, especially related to pregnancy and post-pregnancy, as this failure to just get on with it or just accept it or just do what you've got to do. And so often, of course, in history, this hysteric woman idea was sometimes viewed by physicians as a way for women to escape their domestic circumstances and go lie down and have attention brought to them and not have to carry out their expected duties as wives and mothers, which again, I think is something that still resonates. So rather than a full and humane understanding of how these bodily experiences affect our minds and how the pressures of these socially ordained roles affect women, there's always this victim blaming. It always returns back to some failing within a woman's ability or acceptance of this maternal role. And that is definitely something that we see from the beginnings of medical history to the present.
Right. And so what I see, the manifestations of all of this leftover stuff from history is that it's become so internalized for women in our hearts and in our minds that, oh, we carry around incredible guilt and shame for not living up to this unrealistic standard. And we carry around with us all of the myths of what motherhood is supposed to be. So we have any number of things to feel guilty about and feel ashamed about because we're not living up to these ideals. And in my mind, I didn't fully understand how far back in history this went. In some ways, I was thinking, okay, well, yes, modern motherhood, there's a lot of pressure with social media. And these are things that we didn't have before. And that does bring a whole lot with it. I think added pressure, added ways to feel guilty and compare yourself. But the reality is that this is not new. It's just in a different form and maybe a little more in our face in a new way, but it's been happening for forever.
It really has. I mean, since the beginnings of modern medicine, when women's reproductive bodies began to be controlled in a medical way, medical ideas and social ideas about how women should feel as mothers, what women should do with their bodies as they're becoming mothers, how women should forget themselves in order to adopt their maternal roles, have been enforced again and again and again by these sort of dominant ideas about these kind of ideal mother, what this ideal mother means within society. And of course, the payout of that, the expenditure of that for us is that we do have this guilt and shame, this long embedded, very ingrained sense of guilt and shame if we do not feel the way we're told to feel. So much, I think so much pain has been buried under this ideal for so many centuries and not discussed. And when it is discussed, it's frightening because the opposite of the ideal mother is this monstrous pathological mother who doesn't love her children or something. It's very dangerous and scary for a woman to admit to feeling like it's not the most natural thing in the world for her to do, because this is what we have funneled women into having to do. And we've also always throughout history equated maternity, maternal love, maternal well-being with health, with mental and physical health. So that continues to haunt us as well. The idea of the ancient Greek idea that any ailment could be cured effectively with being pregnant and being a mother, and that any diversion from that was a sort of aberration. Everything still comes back to women, to the way women have to police their bodies and minds in order to perform this service, this maternal service to society.
Yeah. As you were talking about it, you made me remember several other iterations of this that I don't want to use up all of your time today, but what I want to, I guess, point listeners to pay attention to who are reading this book is there are a lot of ways that medicine and religion have also been intertwined in this to the benefit of, I don't know, religion and patriarchy. Don't know how to describe that, but there are so many ways that you describe in this book about how we've been controlled. I guess that's how I'd like to say it. Yeah. And it's so disheartening, but so eye-opening at the same time. Yeah. For now, I will just point listeners to read the whole book because it's absolutely worthwhile and so liberating, really. You've given us a gift, I believe. This, for me anyways, it is. Yeah. As we wrap up, I'm hoping and wondering if you can leave us with some of your hopes for people who read this book, takeaways for them, and what you're hoping that they can do with that.
My main hope for all readers of this book, and in fact all women who are having to negotiate the medical and health systems for whatever reason, is to remember that your body is your own, no matter how doctors, physicians, healthcare providers, or other people might make you feel. Your body is always your own, and you're always the best narrator of what is happening within your body and within your mind, even if the system sort of takes that sense of agency and autonomy away from you. It's always your body. I think that over the last 50, 40, 30, 20 years, women have really made incredible strides within this space to push back against the medical control over our lives and to assert the importance of our lived experience, of our stories, of our knowledge, of our understanding of our bodies and minds. And I think conversations like this, podcasts like yours, are crucial because the way that we push back against this, the way that we unravel this history, is by countering the silencing of our bodies with guilt, with shame. This patriarchal medical model has done too effectively over the centuries. We're now in a space where we can share, we can speak, we can come together in community across the world and talk about what it means to live in our bodies, talk about what it means to experience our minds, our lives, our feelings. And that is how we move forward. I really believe that is how we counter this. And that's how we move towards creating a more equitable health culture for all of us.
Absolutely. All right. That's my battle cry. I can't say enough good things, and I can't recommend this book enough. So I will keep recommending it. It's truly has been a gift and an honor to talk with you and for you to share this with us. And I'm just hoping that everyone goes and reads this and gets that message that you're sending out. I thank you so much for your book and your time.
Well, thank you. It's been such a pleasure. I've loved our conversation.
Just this little bit of an interview. We've touched on so many things that I hope you can really resonate with. And for sure, take away that message of hope from Eleanor. If you'd like to connect with her, you can find her on Twitter and IG at Eleanor Cleghorn. And please do, please, 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 I beg you, get this book, Unwell Women. As I said, I listened to it in audio form, and it was really nice to be able to walk around the house and do other things while listening. I believe for me that having the hardcover has helped really to be able to go back and digest and think about some of these important points. If you know anybody who could benefit from the information in this episode, please, please, please share it, as well as share this resource of the book, Unwell Women. I think the more of us that have access to this information, the more empowered we can feel moving forward. Thank you again to Eleanor, and I thank you all for joining us in this episode. Until next time.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Please share this podcast. Together, we can support moms and families so that no one has to deal with this alone. Come connect with us at momandmind.com.
Hello, you sentient ball of stardust. My name is Casey Davis. I'm a therapist, and I'm an author of the book, How to Keep House While Drowning, where I talk about ways to make it a little bit easier to take care of yourself when you're overwhelmed, stressed, have mental health issues, physical health issues, or maybe you're just in a hard season of life. Maybe you're looking for a place that you can come and listen to some practical advice. This is a podcast for all of the self-help rejects. We're going to talk about skills for survival and self-kindness. And I'm going to leave the pop psychology at the door. I promise not to tell you to meditate or to journal. We're just going to give you some really insightful conversations with hopefully some practical advice. So I don't believe you need to pick yourself up by the bootstraps. I don't want you to just try harder, and I don't believe that laziness exists. So join me over on Struggle Care, where we can find compassionate solutions that help us function a little bit better.